You know, when you walk into a physical building, you immediately notice the architecture,
Oh,
right?
yeah, definitely. The big stuff.
Yeah, like the grand staircase, heavy glass doors, the way that the natural light hits the lobby.
Right.
But we rarely notice the invisible architecture, like the ramps tucked away to the side, or, you know, the exact width of the hallways or the precise height of the elevator buttons.
We just sort of expect the physical world to accommodate it.
Exactly. But when you step into the digital world, I mean, that architecture is entirely invisible, and millions of people are walking straight into digital walls that they cannot even see.
Yeah, and right now the Department of Justice has just put a ticking clock on every state and local government to, well, to tear those invisible walls down.
Which is wild. And that ticking clock is really the catalyst for everything we are looking at today on this deep dive.
It really is.
We have this brief, but honestly incredibly significant update notice from ADA.gov. Regarding the DOJ, alongside two massive, highly technical rule books.
Yeah, published by the W3C.
Right. The Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, versions 2.1, and the newly updated 2.2. Okay, let's unpack this. Why are we looking at this right now?
Well, the DOJ just extended the compliance dates for the ADA Title II rule on web content and mobile app accessibility by exactly 1 year.
And Title II applies to state and local governments, right?
Exactly. That means every public university, every city transit site, local libraries, municipal court systems.
They've all been put on notice.
Yeah, they were facing an immediate deadline. And this extension gives them 1 extra year to figure out exactly what these massive rule books mean for their digital infrastructure.
Or else what?
Or they face some pretty severe legal consequences.
Wow, so I'd imagine the panic among those institutions is fairly palpable.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because these guidelines dictate absolutely everything about digital life. I
Everything.
mean, down to the specific shades of color on a municipal payment portal, or the way a student logs into a university course system, or even how a citizen interacts with a transit map on their phone.
Which is why we're doing this deep dive. Because whether you're a developer writing code, a business owner managing a storefront, or just, you know, a daily internet user, understanding these guidelines reveals all the hidden friction in our digital life.
It really pulls back the curtain.
So since we're looking at the W3C's framework, anyone who builds for the web is probably familiar with their foundational principles, the POUR principles.
Right. Perceivable, operable, understandable, and
Yeah,
robust.
every digital interaction has to hit all four. But how they actually grade that architecture is what really caught my eye.
The conformance levels.
Yeah, they use these levels A, AA, and AAA. And looking at it initially, it just feels like video game difficulty settings.
Oh, that's an interesting way to put it.
Right, like level A is easy or casual for the developer, AA is normal mode, and AAA is like hardcore mode where you are just showing off your coding skills to the final boss.
I see the temptation to frame it around the developer's effort, but the mechanism here is entirely about the depth of accommodation for the user, not the difficulty of the code.
Oh, really?
Yeah, level A is the absolute baseline. Missing level A means your website is fundamentally locking out entire populations.
Wow. Okay, so what about AA?
Level AA is the standard legal target. It provides a strong, comprehensive level of accessibility. And then level AAA is the ultimate gold standard of accommodation.
But wait, the sources explicitly note that level AAA is not recommended as a general policy for entire sites.
Right.
Which is so counterintuitive to me. My first instinct is that everything should just be AAA. Like, why wouldn't we want the gold standard everywhere?
Well, think about what that would actually require.
Yeah, I guess thinking about it, if I have a complex data visualization for a scientific paper, simplifying it to meet a AAA middle school reading level might actually, you know, destroy the scientific data.
Exactly. It'd lose the nuance entirely.
So instead of difficulty, it's more like physical architecture. Like level A is putting a wooden plank over a step. Level AA is pouring a permanent concrete ramp. And level AAA is installing a specialized mechanical elevator.
That is a much more accurate way to look at it. You wouldn't mandate mechanical elevators for every single 1-inch threshold on Earth. I mean, it's practically impossible.
Yeah, that makes sense.
AA is the sweet spot. The guidelines balance universal access with practical reality.
And the specific mechanics they use to measure these things are just fascinating. Like, let's look at that perceivable principle.
Oh, the contrast rules.
Yes, there is actual math behind the colors we see online. Standard text needs a 4.5-to-1 contrast ratio against its background. I always assume designers just kind of eyeballed what looked readable.
A lot of people think that.
But this is a hard mathematical rule based on relative luminance.
And the math is crucial because human eyes process light differently. The 4.5 to 1 ratio calculates the relative luminance, which is essentially the intensity of light emitted.
So it's comparing the lightest color to the darkest color.
Exactly. It accounts for the loss in contrast sensitivity that's typically experienced by users with vision loss, which is roughly equivalent to a visual acuity of 20/40. So it's not subjective at all. A computer can analyze the exact hex codes of your background and your text and objectively spit out a pass or fail grade.
That's incredible. But the exception to this rule is brilliant. Logotypes. If text is part of a logo or a brand name, there is absolutely zero contrast requirement. You could have a neon yellow logo on a white background, and WCAG says, sure, go ahead.
Well, if they forced companies to abandon their trademarked brand colors, these guidelines would be rejected universally.
Ooh.
It's a negotiation.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
And we see that same precision in the operable principle, which gets right into human neurology.
Right.
There is a strict rule called three flashes or below threshold. A web page mechanically cannot contain anything that flashes more than three times in a 1 second period.
The specificity of that three times in 1 second, it sounds like a very deliberate threshold.
No.
How did they land on that exact metric?
It is tied directly to the medical reality of photosensitive epilepsy. Yeah. Neurologically, visual flashing in the 3 to 70 hertz range, meaning 3 to 70 flashes per second, is the danger zone for triggering physical seizures in susceptible individuals.
Oh my God.
Right. By capping any web animation or video at 3 flashes per second, the W3C is literally preventing digital content from causing acute medical emergencies.
That is wild. It's a stark reminder that digital design has severe, real-world physical consequences.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, these criteria aren't just for people with severe disabilities. They improve usability for aging populations and, well, users in general.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The web isn't a static document anymore.
No, not at all.
The transition from WCAG 2.1 to the new WCAG 2.2 reflects a massive shift in how human beings actually interface with information today.
It's a completely different landscape now.
Right, because when those early guidelines were written, the default assumption was, you know, a user sitting stationary at a desk, looking at a monitor, using a keyboard, and a highly precise laser mouse.
Today, the paradigm is a person holding a pane of glass while walking down a crowded street, tapping it with a thumb.
Exactly.
So WCAG 2.2 introduces several new success criteria, specifically to address the physical mechanics of mobile devices and touchscreens.
And the one that instantly jumped out at me is the new target size minimum rule.
Oh, that's a big one.
It dictates that interactive targets, like buttons, icons, or text links, must be at least 24 by 24 CSS pixels.
Yep.
And I immediately thought of the universal frustration of trying to tap a tiny hyperlink on a phone screen, missing by a millimeter, and accidentally clicking the ad next to it.
Everyone hates that. The 24 by 24 CSS pixel rule establishes a mathematical safe zone. But it is important to unpack the mechanism here, because a CSS pixel is not necessarily a physical hardware pixel on your monitor.
Wait, really? What is it then?
It is a density-independent measurement of visual angle.
Meaning it's a mathematical abstraction. So if I am holding a high-resolution phone close to my face versus looking at a lower-resolution monitor across the desk, that 24 by 24 box scales to stay roughly the physical size of an average adult thumb pad.
Precisely. It guarantees that the interactive element maps to the physical dimensions of human anatomy, regardless of the device's hardware specs.
That is so smart.
Yeah, it accommodates people with physical tremors, but also anyone trying to use their device on a bumpy bus ride.
But the mobile mechanics get even more complicated with Rule 2.5.7 dragging movements. Any functionality requiring a dragging motion must have a single pointer alternative.
Right.
And my immediate thought is things like drag and drop maps or those little volume sliders where you drag the dot back and forth. If I have to provide an alternative, does that mean those intuitive swipe and drag interfaces are being outlawed?
No. The source text is very careful to clarify this. The dragging functionality can absolutely remain. However, the mechanism of sustaining a press and hold motion while simultaneously moving across a screen, it requires a high degree of sustained fine motor control.
I can see that.
Many users, particularly those with mobility impairments or conditions like Parkinson's, simply cannot maintain that sustained pressure.
Wow, yeah, I didn't even think about that.
So you must provide an alternative way to achieve the exact same result using a single click or tap.
Oh, I get it. So on a map, you can still click and drag to pan, but you must also render up, down, left, and right arrow buttons that a user can just tap sequentially.
Exactly.
You know, while looking at this transition from 2.1 to 2.2, I noticed something that completely upended how I thought about these rules.
What was that?
They didn't just add new constraints for mobile. They actually killed an existing rule.
They did.
Success criterion 4.1.1, called parsing, is completely gone, obsolete, removed. And my instinct is that if we delete a rule from an accessibility framework, the web inherently gets less accessible.
It's a fair assumption. But this raises an important question about how guidelines interact with the evolution of underlying technology.
How so?
Well, the parsing rule historically required web authors to write perfectly structured HTML.
Mm-hmm.
No duplicate attributes, perfectly nested tags, unique IDs.
Because the old tech needed it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
In the late 90s and 2000s, early assistive technologies like screen readers for blind users had to read the raw HTML code directly.
Oh, wow.
If a developer forgot to close a div tag, the screen reader software would literally crash or read the entire page as gibberish.
So bad code meant a completely broken experience. But if that rule is gone, does that mean bad code doesn't break screen readers anymore?
The technology caught up. Modern web browsers, Chrome, Safari, Firefox, they have become incredibly robust at handling bad code.
They just fix it.
Basically, yeah. Today, the browser acts as an intelligent buffer. It takes whatever messy, broken HTML the developer wrote, automatically builds a clean document object model, fixes the missing tags, and hands a pristine, standardized accessibility tree to the screen reader.
That is amazing.
The assistive technology never even sees the raw HTML anymore. It only looks at what the browser hands it.
So it's foolproof.
I mean, writing bad HTML is still terrible practice, but it no longer creates a direct barrier for the disabled user. The technology solved the problem on its own, so the rule outlived its usefulness.
See, if modern browsers are so smart that they automatically fix broken code, then the ultimate barrier to accessibility isn't the technology anymore, it's the user's brain.
That is exactly right.
And that perfectly explains the biggest shift in WCAG 2.2. While earlier versions focused heavily on physical and sensory barriers like color contrast, screen readers, dragging a mouse, this new version targets cognitive load. We are looking at the end of digital interrogation.
And cognitive accessibility has historically been the hardest area to regulate.
Why is that?
Well, it is mathematically simple to test if a color contrast is 4.5 to 1, right? Mm. But it is incredibly difficult to objectively test if a checkout process is too confusing.
Oh, yeah, that's incredibly subjective.
Exactly. But WCAG 2.2 finally codifies concrete rules to reduce cognitive friction.
And the first one is Rule 3.3.7, Redundant Entry. This rule dictates that if a user enters information once, they should not have to enter it again in the same process. It must auto-populate or be available to select.
Yes.
Think about going to a new doctor's office, and the receptionist hands you 5 different clipboards, and you have to write your name, address, and date of birth on every single piece of paper.
It's the worst.
It is infuriating in the physical world, yet the internet has forced us to do it on multi-page forms for decades.
Right. And for someone with a cognitive disability, learning disability, or short-term memory impairment, that repetition is not merely a nuisance. It is an insurmountable wall.
Because they just lose their place.
Yeah. If a user has to navigate away from a checkout page to check their billing zip code, and the site forces them to retype their entire shipping address because the form reset, they may simply abandon the transaction.
That makes total sense.
The rule transfers the burden of memory from the human being to the computer system.
But the absolute biggest shift in cognitive accessibility is accessible authentication, covered in rules 3.3.8 and 3.3.9.
Oh, definitely.
These rules explicitly ban mandatory cognitive function tests for logging into an account. And the W3C defines a cognitive function test as memorization, calculation, or transcription.
Yep.
They are officially recognizing that remembering a password and typing it out is a cognitive barrier.
It really is.
I think about my own bank. I generate a secure 16-character password in my password manager. I go to the bank's login page, and for some misguided reason of security, they have disabled right-click and the paste function in the password field.
So frustrating.
I have to stare at my manager and manually transcribe a string of random letters and numbers, usually messing it up twice and locking my account.
What's fascinating here is the total paradigm shift in how we view security.
How so?
Well, For the entire history of the commercial internet, security has been predicated on the user's ability to remember and accurately transcribe complex strings of characters. We normalized demanding that human beings remember a 12-character password with a capital letter, a number, and a special symbol.
Which nobody can do.
Exactly. WCAG 2.2 draws a hard line. That is a cognitive function test, and you cannot legally force a user to pass a memory test just to access their own data.
So how do websites secure accounts without requiring passwords? They obviously still need authentication.
Well, the rules do not eliminate passwords. They require that systems provide an alternative that bypasses the cognitive function test.
Okay, like what?
The guidelines explicitly mandate support for password managers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that bank blocking your copy and paste function. Under WCAG 2.2, that is a direct accessibility violation.
That is wild to me.
Copy and paste is now essentially a civil right in digital design because it allows software to handle the transcription.
Are there other alternatives?
Other acceptable alternatives include object recognition, like identifying a personal picture you uploaded previously, or utilizing biometric authentication like a fingerprint or face ID, which relies on physical presence rather than memory or transcription.
It is wild to think of copy and paste as an accessibility requirement, but it makes perfect sense.
It really does.
There is one more cognitive rule that stood out, consistent help.
Right.
If a website offers help mechanisms like contact info, an FAQ section, or an automated chatbot, they have to be placed in the exact same relative order across multiple web pages. It respects the user's mental map.
Exactly.
Like, if I know the little chat bubble is in the bottom right corner on the homepage, it better be in the bottom right corner when I am buried deep in a settings menu. Don't make me hunt for help when I'm already frustrated.
It reduces the cognitive load of spatial orientation. A user with executive function challenges shouldn't have to relearn the interface geometry on every single page load.
So what does this all mean? Think about what you did on your phone or laptop this morning. Whether you were squinting at a complex spreadsheet in a brightly lit coffee shop, or trying to tap a tiny link while walking your dog, or relying on a password manager to get into your email.
We all do it.
These principles, maintaining high color luminance, ensuring targets map to human thumbs, and reducing cognitive memory loads, they aren't abstract compliance checkboxes. They are the invisible architecture that makes the digital world survivable.
And the urgency of implementing this architecture cannot be overstated.
Right, going back to the DOJ.
Returning to the ADA.gov notice, the Department of Justice Title II extension means the grace period is actively ticking down.
1 year.
Exactly. State and local governments, public universities, municipal services, they have 1 year to adapt their infrastructure to these realities. The digital world is finally being retrofitted to accommodate human beings, rather than forcing human beings to contort their minds and bodies to fit the technology.
But there is a final, slightly provocative thought hidden deep in the back of these W3C documents.
Mm-hmm.
Both version 2.1 and 2.2 contain a quiet note acknowledging that these rule books are just interim measures.
Wow, interim.
Yeah. The W3C is developing a completely new, radically different major version of accessibility guidelines in parallel, often referred to as Project Silver.
Right.
And it's moving away from just judging the developer's code to taking into account user agents like the browsers themselves and automated AI tools.
That changes everything.
So think about this. If modern browsers already fix broken HTML, what happens when artificial intelligence and next generation browsers can automatically restructure the entire web page on the fly?
Oh, wow.
Altering the contrast math, resizing the target areas, and simplifying the text to suit an individual's precise sensory and cognitive profile in real time. When that happens, will we even need guidelines for human authors anymore?
That's a great question.
Or will the internet simply mold itself, like invisible architecture shifting its shape, to perfectly fit whoever happens to be walking through the digital door?
That is the ultimate promise of technology, not just to build better walls, but to engineer an environment where the walls remove themselves.
Until then, check your contrast ratios. Thanks for taking the deep dive with us.